As long as the functioning of the brain remains a mystery to us, the universe will also remain a mystery. Wow. That's a quote from Santiago Ramon y Cajal, right from the notes we're diving into today. Yeah, it really sets the stage, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, we're tackling some of the absolute biggest, oldest questions humans have ever asked themselves.
Totally. Like, what is consciousness? How does our mind relate to our body? That whole mind-body thing. And, you know, could machines ever actually think or feel like us?
Exactly. And that's our goal here in this deep dive. We've got this collection of notes, excerpts, philosophical viewpoints, scientific arguments, all focused on these huge topics.
And we're going to try and pull out the most important bits, right? Get a handle on the main arguments and maybe see how these like centuries-old philosophical debates connect up with what's happening right now in AI and neuroscience.
Think of it as your shortcut, maybe. A way to get up to speed on, well, millennia of thought, really. From ancient philosophy right up to the very latest questions about AI, we're trying to connect those dots for you.
Okay, sounds good. So, where do we start? Maybe right back at the beginning or near enough. This fundamental puzzle, mind-body reality.
Yeah, the classic mind-body problem, or, you know, sometimes it's called the psychophysical problem. But basically it's this. How does our inner world, our subjective experience,
like feeling happy or seeing the color blue?
Exactly. How does all that relate to the external physical world? You know, the world of neurons firing, chemicals reacting, actual objects out there. They just seem so fundamentally different. How can they possibly connect?
And people throughout history have come up with some really fascinating, sometimes pretty extreme answers.
Oh, yeah. You've got ideas like solipsism, basically, only my mind exists and everything else is just in my head.
Bit lonely, that one.
Huh, yeah. Or idealism, like Bishop Berkeley, arguing that everything is actually mental. There is no separate physical reality.
And then the really famous one, dualism.
Right, Descartes being the big name there. Mind and body are two totally separate kinds of stuff, thinking stuff and physical stuff. And, you know, even more recently, you had people like the neuroscientist Sir John Eccles arguing for something similar, like non-material things interacting with the brain.
But the notes mentioned some even weirder historical attempts. Occasionalism.
Oh, occasionalism. Yeah. Jalinks and Malebranche. Their idea was, okay, mind and matter are separate, totally separate. Physical events don't cause mental ones.
So how does anything happen?
Well, according to them, a physical event, like, say, you stub your toe, that's just the occasion for God to step in and directly cause the feeling of pain in your mind.
So God is like the universal remote control for feelings.
Pretty much. Constant divine intervention for every little sensation. And the source actually points out that, maybe surprisingly, you can still find echoes of that kind of thinking today, you know, invoking external, non-empirical forces to explain the mind-body link, especially in some more speculative physics.
Okay, so needing God to sync everything up constantly seems, well, complicated. Were there other ways thinkers tried to get around that dualist interaction problem?
Yeah, there were. Leibniz, for example, came up with his monads idea.
Monads, okay.
He saw reality as made of these infinite, tiny, simple substances, monads, that don't actually interact with each other at all.
Wait, if they don't interact, how does anything work?
Well, God, at the moment of creation, pre-programmed all of them to run in perfect sync. It's called pre-established harmony. So your mental monad wanting to lift your arm is perfectly synchronized with your body monads doing the lifting, but one doesn't cause the other. It's like perfectly synchronized clocks.
Millions and millions of tiny preset clocks.
Wow. Okay. What about Spinoza?
Spinoza went a different way. He was a monist, only one fundamental substance. He called it God or nature.
So not two substances like Descartes?
Nope, just one. And mind and body, they aren't separate things. They're just two parallel attributes or ways of looking at that one single substance. So changes happen in parallel in the mental view and the physical view. Like looking at the same thing from two different windows.
Kind of, yeah. Which gives us the illusion of free will, he thought. But actually, everything is determined by the laws of this one substance, God nature. For Spinoza, real freedom was understanding that necessity.
These old models, they feel pretty awkward, I guess, from our modern perspective.
They do, don't they? And the source suggests that really highlights how difficult it is, conceptually, to bridge that gap between subjective feeling and objective matter. Spinoza, though, was onto something with the parallel changes idea. Sometimes it is easier to explain things mentally, like feeling dizzy when you see someone.
Rather than trying to describe all the exact brain chemistry happening.
Exactly. Or vice versa, sometimes the physical explanation is easier, like a stroke causing language problems. But the source argues part of why we struggle, why these models feel weird, is maybe because we don't have artificial systems with rich internal perspectives to compare with. Our imagination is limited by our experience.
And the source seems pretty critical of traditional dualism and idealism, suggesting they haven't really moved forward or helped explain experiments. It even uses the term lack of plasticity.
Yeah, the implication is that if a philosophical idea doesn't adapt or help explain new evidence, its usefulness, at least scientifically, is pretty limited. That seems to be the viewpoint in the notes.
Okay, so that brings us to someone who tried to resolve the problem using language. Gilbert Ryle.
Right, Ryle. An analytical philosopher, his whole approach was about clearing up philosophical muddles by analyzing how we misuse language, what he called systematically misleading expressions.
And his big target was that idea of the mind being a separate thing.
Absolutely. His famous book, The Concept of Mind, from 1949, he really attacked this idea of a sort of hidden controller, a ghost in the machine pulling the strings.
That's a great phrase, ghost in the machine.
Isn't it? He said believing in that kind of mind was a categorical mistake. He used that famous analogy. Someone visits Oxford, sees all the colleges, libraries, labs, students, and then asks, okay, but where's the university?
Right, the university isn't another building alongside the others.
Exactly. It's the way all those things are organized and function together. It's not a separate entity.
So for Ryle, the mind isn't a thing. What is it then?
He argued it's basically just a way of talking about how people behave, their tendencies, their abilities, their dispositions. Saying someone's smart isn't pointing to an inner smartness thing. It's describing their disposition to act intelligently, solve problems, learn fast, and so on. The source lists loads of examples like make up one's mind or sharp mind.
They're descriptions of behavior patterns, not hidden internal states.
That was his view. And if you can reduce mind talk to talk about dispositions, well, poof. The mind-body problem seems to just dissolve.
But the source we're looking at doesn't fully buy Ryle's solution.
No, it pushes back. It agrees with Ryle that the mind isn't a separate thing, and notes we do tend to turn concepts into things, we reify them. But it argues Ryle goes too far in saying the mind is just dispositions.
Why? What's missing?
The source argues the concept of mind is still useful, even necessary. Psychology isn't just about brain firings. It involves understanding things like intentional experiences, thoughts about something, subjective feelings. The source claims these are different from just neurophysiology, even though they depend on it. Your past experiences might be physically stored in your brain structure, but understanding their meaning, their sense, often needs a psychological level of interpretation.
That connects to another point in the notes about how language itself shapes how we think about things, right? Like David Bohm's idea.
Exactly. Bohm talked about how our typical subject-verb-object language structure tends to make us see the world as lots of separate things acting on each other. I have a brain. I have free will. As if the I is separate.
Like the owner of the brain.
Right. Bohm suggested other language forms, more process-oriented ones, might give a different view. And the source connects this by saying the self isn't some central controller, but it's actually a model the brain creates. Even in physics, talking about one particle acting on another is often just an approximation of a more complex interaction.
So maybe it's better to think of the mind not as one single thing, but more like a collection of processes.
That's definitely closer to Marvin Minsky's idea, the society of mind. He was a pioneer in AI. He proposed the mind isn't one unified thing, but like a huge society of interacting, specialized little functions or agents.
That sounds influential for AI.
Hugely. It led to things like multi-agent systems. But as the source points out, while it's a powerful model for function, it doesn't really explain the qualitative feel of experience, you know, the subjective side.
Which kind of leads us neatly into section three, this big shift in thinking driven by technology, the whole information processing revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. The metaphors we use for the mind keep changing, often reflecting the latest tech, you know, hydraulic pumps, telephone switchboards. And then in the 20th century, the computer program became the dominant metaphor.
And this happened partly because earlier psychological approaches ran into trouble.
That's right. Things like introspectionism, trying to study the mind by looking inwards, or early psychophysics, trying to precisely measure sensations, they struggled to get objective, consistent results everyone could agree on.
Creating an opening for. Behaviorism.
Yep. Think Pavlov's dogs, Skinner's boxes. Watson and Skinner really wanted psychology to be scientific, like physics. So they said, let's only study what we can objectively see and measure. Behavior. Stimulus in, response out. Forget about consciousness, thoughts, feelings. You can't see them, so they're not scientific.
But that turned out to be too limited, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. It really struggled with complex stuff, especially language. Noam Chomsky's critique of Skinner was devastating, and simple behaviorist ideas failed miserably when people tried things like automated language translation. It just didn't work.
So people started thinking there must be something going on inside the black box.
Exactly. Even later behaviorists, neo-behaviorists like Tolman, started allowing for internal, unobservable variables. But the real shift came with cognitivism.
What drove it?
Chomsky's work on language was a huge theoretical push, but it was massively fueled by the breakthroughs happening in computing and artificial intelligence. There was this real pragmatic attitude. To understand it, you have to be able to build it.
If you can build a machine that acts intelligently using simple parts, you don't need a ghost.
Precisely. The focus shifted entirely to information processing, symbols, rules. The idea was that mental states are computational states.
And this is where functionalism really comes into its own.
Yes. Functionalism became the kind of default philosophy for cognitivism. The notes lay out its core ideas. One, mental states are defined by their function, what they do, not what they're made of. Two, that function is defined by inputs, outputs, and relations to other states. Three, these relations are causal.
So the physical stuff, neurons, silicon chips, whatever is secondary.
That's the idea of multiple realizability. A belief, like it's going to rain, could theoretically be realized in your brain or in a sufficiently complex computer or maybe even, you know, in some bizarre network of pipes and valves, as long as it plays the same functional role in the system. The source contrasts this with carbon chauvinism. The belief only squishy brains like ours can think.
So functionalism is about finding the right level of abstraction. Like, how much detail do we need to model?
Exactly what the source calls functionalist minimalism. What's the minimum needed to capture the essential functions we call mind? Mind becomes a function of physical information processing, an algorithm running on a brain or an equivalent machine. Minsky's Society of Processes fits right in here.
And the extreme version of this is strong AI.
Right. That's John Searle's term for the claim that if you program a computer correctly, it doesn't just simulate a mind, it is a mind. It literally has cognitive states.
But the source brings up a distinction here between the process and the physical thing carrying it out.
Yeah, it uses analogies like the bits on a DVD aren't the same as the interactive game experience, or simulating a hurricane on a supercomputer doesn't make the computer wet.
The simulation isn't the real thing.
In those cases, yeah. The source argues information needs an actualizer. A physical system, a body interacting with the world, like a musical score needs an orchestra, or DNA needs a cell and an environment. Our bodies, our interactions, shape our minds.
What about meaning? If it's all symbol manipulation, where does the meaning come from, the symbol grounding problem?
Ah, yes, the symbol grounding problem. That's a huge one. How do abstract symbols, like the word dog, actually connect to, well, dogs? The source suggests that basic concepts get grounded in our sensorimotor systems, our physical interactions with the world. Understanding chair isn't just knowing a definition. It's linked to the potential actions of sitting, lifting, seeing it from different angles.
So for an AI to truly understand, it needs more than just rules. It needs some kind of connection to the world.
That seems to be the implication. AI systems trying to achieve understanding need massive knowledge bases, rules about how the world works. The source mentions the CYC project, trying to encode millions of common sense facts. But then you hit that question again, does CYC really understand, or is it just clever symbol shuffling?
Like, is it just a fancy thermostat?
Kind of. We might say a thermostat knows it's too cold. Is that just a metaphor? Probably. But the source suggests that as systems get more complex, like a tick, a dog, a chimp, our willingness to attribute genuine cognitive states grows. It's a spectrum, perhaps.
And this knowledge, these symbols, they have to exist physically somehow, right?
Absolutely. As patterns of neurons firing or charges in silicon, symbols are abstract categories, but they need a physical token. The source talks about a physical symbolic system, PSS. Physical tokens manipulated by rules, which are also physical, based on their shape, their syntax. But the whole system, interacting with the world and its own internal states, allows it to be semantically interpretable, to have meaning.
Meaning isn't in the symbols themselves, but in the whole system's connections.
Yeah, No word has meaning independent of context, as the source puts it. And this system allows for combinatorial productivity, making infinite new meaningful combinations. The idea is that because the symbolic rules work regardless of the physical implementation, there's a kind of autonomy at the symbolic level. Though whether that level alone is enough for everything mind-like is the big question.
Which brings us back to, what is intelligence anyway? Can we even measure it simply?
Well, the source definitely questions the idea of a single IQ score or G factor capturing everything. It points out that early IQ tests had problematic links to eugenics. And Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, things like kinesthetic, interpersonal, musical intelligence, suggests we need different skills for different tasks.
It's not all just logic puzzles.
Not at all. Emotional intelligence, spatial skills, coordination. You can't be an intelligent surgeon without amazing dexterity, right? It's multifaceted.
That complexity is really important when we ask if a machine can be intelligent, which leads us straight into section 4, Alan Turing and his test.
Right. Alan Turing, giant of computer science. He had this core idea. You could get complex, seemingly intelligent behavior out of simple mechanical steps, like code breaking, or his analogy of different programmers collaborating on a chess program that could beat grandmasters.
And instead of getting bogged down defining thinking, he proposed a test.
Exactly. In his 1950 paper, he proposed the imitation game, now the Turing test. Can a human interrogator talking via text tell the difference between a human and a machine also responding via text? If you can't tell them apart, he argued, on what basis do you deny the machine is thinking?
And people still run versions of this test today, right? The Loebner Prize.
They do. And the source notes that for a long time, progress was pretty slow. But recently, with these huge large language models, they've gotten scarily good.
But passing the test isn't necessarily the final word.
That's the caution the source adds. Passing in a limited chat doesn't automatically mean full human-like understanding or consciousness. Context matters. Who is the judge? Are they easily fooled?
Turing actually anticipated a lot of the objections people would raise. What were some big ones he tackled?
Okay, one was the theological objection. You know, machines can't think because they don't have souls. Turing basically said, that's faith, not science. And anyway, a theologian could just say God can give a soul to anything he wants.
What's the modern version of that?
Maybe something like Eccles's psychons, non-material things influencing the brain. But the source is quick to say there's zero evidence for that, and plenty of evidence that physical brain processes do cause mental states.
Then there's the head in the sand objection.
Huh, yeah. Basically, just fear. People being scared of the consequences if machines could think. It challenges our special place in the universe, you know? The source links this to how people denied computers could beat humans at chess or Go right up until they did. It's a kind of motivated skepticism.
What about the mathematical objection, using Gödel's theorems?
Right. This was pushed by Lucas, and later, famously, by Roger Penrose. The argument is, Gödel showed there are true mathematical statements that formal systems, like computer programs, can't prove, but humans supposedly can see are true. Therefore, human minds aren't just computer programs.
What was Turing's response and the source's take?
Turing's response was pretty down to earth. Humans make mistakes too. And our practical limits, memory, speed are way more significant than these theoretical limits on idealized machines. The source adds that most modern AI isn't based on rigid logical proof systems anyway. It uses statistics, learning, heuristic stuff. Gödel's theorems don't really apply to in the same way. These theorems limit absolute mathematical omniscience, not practical problem solving or discovery.
Okay, the big one, the consciousness objection. Machines can't feel, they don't have subjective experience, qualia, Chalmers' hard problem.
Yeah, this is probably the stickiest objection. Turing's counter was pragmatic, almost behaviorist. Look, how do you know other people have feelings? Only by observing what they do and say. If a machine passes the test perfectly, consistently denying it a mind because you can't see its feelings, pushes you towards solipsism, believing only your mind is real.
We'll get more into this with the Chinese room, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. But the source does note progress in effective computing, trying to build systems that recognize and even simulate emotions. And it mentions these large language models showing surprising abilities like theory of mind, figuring out what others might be thinking, even understanding irony or false beliefs. They're not perfect. They make social gaffes, but it's developing.
What about all those other things people said machines couldn't do? Be creative, fall in love, enjoy strawberries.
Turing saw those as arguments from ignorance. Just because machines then couldn't do those things didn't mean they never could. And the source points out, AI is creative now, in some ways generating art, music, finding patterns in scientific data. There's no fundamental law of physics preventing machine learning or exploration. Our predictions are often just limited by our current tech.
And the point that the brain isn't purely digital, it's analog, continuous.
Turing acknowledged that but thought digital computers could approximate continuous systems well enough. The source adds that actually we do have analog neuromorphic computers now, which mimic brain processes more directly, use less energy, and aren't strictly discrete. Plus, many complex software systems today are too complex to describe with simple rules anyway. They use randomness, adaptive algorithms. AI doesn't have to be just rigid rules.
DFP.
Turing mentioned it because it was a popular topic then. Basically said, not significant for normal thinking, even if it exists, and still no evidence.
So this whole mind is like software analogy, useful or not?
The source says, useful, but imperfect. A program is abstract. The process involves the hardware, too, the robot body, the sensors. The Turing test evaluates that whole functioning system. But again, passing the test doesn't automatically equal consciousness. Is IBM's Watson aware it won Jeopardy? We can't really say.
Yeah.
Attributing subjective states is still a leap.
And that leap is exactly what John Searle challenges with the Chinese Room argument in Section 5.
Right. Searle comes along in 1980, specifically targeting strong AI and functionalism. He wants to show that just manipulating symbols according to rules, which is what he says computers do, can never produce real understanding or meaning, what philosophers call intentionality.
He calls it semantic impotence.
That's the phrase. So the thought experiment. Imagine you, an English speaker who knows zero Chinese, are locked in a room.
Okay.
People outside slide slips of paper under the door with Chinese questions written on them. Inside, you have a huge rule book written in English. The rule book says, if you see this squiggle followed by that squiggle, then write down this other squiggle and pass it back out.
So I'm just matching shapes, following instructions.
Exactly. You're manipulating symbols purely based on their form, their syntax. You have no idea what any of it means. But the rule book is so good that to the Chinese speakers outside, the answers you pass out are perfectly coherent, meaningful replies to their questions. They think whoever is in the room understands Chinese.
But I absolutely don't understand a word of it.
Precisely Searle's point. If you, doing exactly what a computer program does, following rules, manipulating symbols syntactically, don't understand Chinese, then neither does the computer program just running the rules. Conclusion: syntax is not enough for semantics. Formal symbol manipulation doesn't give you meaning.
That's a powerful argument. It caused quite a stir, right?
Yeah.
What were the main replies?
Oh, yeah. Tons of replies. The source goes through the big ones. First is the system reply.
Which says?
It says, okay, the person in the room doesn't understand. But the whole system, the person, the rule book, the slips of paper, the room, that entire system understands Chinese.
What did Searle think of that?
He wasn't impressed. He said, okay, imagine the person memorizes the entire rule book and does it all in their head, maybe walks around outside. They still don't understand Chinese. Calling the whole setup understanding is like saying his stomach understands digestion. He thought it leads to panpsychism, the idea that understanding is everywhere, in walls and thermostats.
Okay, what about the robot reply?
This one says, the problem is the room is disconnected. Put the computer program in a robot with sensors and motors, let it interact with the world. Then its symbols could be grounded in experience and gain meaning.
Makes sense. Searle's comeback.
He says, imagine you're inside the robot's head, watching the sensory inputs correlate with the symbol manipulations and the motor outputs. You still wouldn't understand the Chinese conversation the robot is having. You'd just see meaningless symbols linked to sensor data.
Then there's the brain simulator reply.
Yeah, this argues maybe just simulating the rules isn't enough. What if you simulate the actual causal powers of the neurons in a Chinese speaker's brain?
Replicate what the brain actually does physically.
Right. Searle's rebuttal is twofold. First, we don't really know exactly what those specific causal powers are beyond just neural activity. Second, even if you simulate every neuron and synapse on a computer, from his perspective, you're still just doing symbol manipulation, albeit at a lower level. It's still syntax. Just arranging the simulation like a brain doesn't guarantee understanding, he claims.
So Searle's conclusions are pretty firm, then.
Very. The source summarizes them. Programs alone can't create minds. Just simulating brain computations isn't enough. Minds need the specific causal powers of biology. Robots running programs can't have human-like minds. Mental states are biological phenomena. Brains cause minds. Full stop. Though the source does add a little note that maybe modern machine learning, where the system changes its structure, slightly complicates his program's our pure syntax premise.
But the source we're using also offers a pretty detailed critique of Searle's Chinese Room itself.
It does. It points out, for instance, the sheer complexity, could a human really follow such rules fast enough? It raises Polishin's silicon brain thought experiment. If you slowly replace your neurons with functionally identical silicon chips, does your understanding suddenly blink out? Seems unlikely. Which makes Searle's appeal to mysterious biological causal powers seem a bit unhelpful, maybe sterile.
What about the Chinese gymnasium idea?
Right, Hofstadter and Dennett, they varied the parameters. What if the system was brain-sized, neuron-fast, made of different stuff? Searle's setup is very specific, paper, human speed, extract concepts. The critique is that Searle seems to just assume from the start that only biology can do the trick.
And the observer problem comes up again.
Yes. The source makes a key point. If you looked inside a real human brain, you wouldn't see thoughts or understanding, either just neurons firing. So why demand that an observer inside the Chinese room, even a super fast complex one, should have a feeling of understanding? Maybe, the source suggests, the feeling I understand is just another brain signal, not the understanding itself. Understanding might be something you do, operationally demonstrated by behavior, not necessarily something you feel internally in that specific way.
And the simulation point is revisited too.
Yeah. Well, simulating a storm isn't a storm. The source argues physical simulation using the right kind of substrate, like neuromorphic chips that mimic neural processing, could potentially recreate the relevant causal states. The Chinese room, just shuffling paper, lacks embodiment, memory, imagination. It's maybe more like a philosophical zombie.
There's a paradox mentioned.
Right. If the person in the room happened to already know Chinese, the rules and outputs would make sense to them. So, does understanding flip on or off based only on the internal person's knowledge, even when the external behavior is identical? It suggests neither external behavior nor internal observation of the rule following is a definitive test.
So, how does this source compare the Turing test and the Chinese room as actual tests?
It sees the Turing test, if done well, as a potentially valid test for functional equivalence. Does the system do what a thinking human does in conversation? It can rule systems out. The Chinese room, on the other hand, is criticized as being set up to always give a negative answer, even applied to a brain observed internally. It's seen less as a fair test and more as an argument based on intuition that denies symbolic systems can understand. The source concludes we need better ways to define and evaluate understanding in both humans and AI, and maybe some form of Turing test is still necessary for that.
Okay, let's shift slightly. Section 6 tackles another big challenge to computational views of the mind, this time from physics Roger Penrose.
Professor Sir Roger Penrose, yeah. Nobel Prize winner. His books, like The Emperor's New Mind, argue strongly against strong AI, using Gödel's incompleteness theorems and the Church-Turing thesis.
Similar basis to the mathematical objection Turing addressed, but Penrose takes it further.
He does. His core argument is there are mathematical truths, like certain Gödel statements that no algorithmic computer system can ever prove, but which Penrose claims human mathematicians can intuitively grasp as true.
Therefore,
human understanding, human consciousness, must involve something non-algorithmic, non-computable. He speculates this requires new physics, maybe quantum gravity effects happening in tiny brain structures called microtubules.
Okay, that's a big claim. How does the source respond to Penrose?
Critically. First, like with the earlier mathematical objection, it points out his argument focuses on formal logic, while most AI uses statistical methods, learning, etc., which aren't really limited by Gödel in that way.
And can humans reliably solve these uncomputable problems?
The source doubts it, arguing our ability to handle truly non-algorithmic tasks is very limited. And where we can represent knowledge well, machines often outperform us now.
What about the quantum physics and microtubules idea?
The source calls it speculative and lacking empirical support. It argues that quantum effects are generally washed out in the warm, noisy environment of the brain over the timescales needed for thought. And crucially, these quantum ideas don't actually explain any specific phenomena of consciousness that scientists actually study, like why optical illusions work or how decisions are made.
Penrose had categories for consciousness theories, right? A, B, C, D.
Yeah. A was basically strong AI. Computation is consciousness. B was computable physics causes consciousness, but simulation isn't the real thing. D was it's all a mystery. Penrose dismissed A and B and championed C. Uncomputable physics is needed. The source critiques his reasons for dismissing A and B, suggesting they're based on flawed interpretations like ignoring the potential for physical simulation in B.
So the overall take on Penrose and uncomputability.
The source concludes that these mathematical arguments about theoretical limits don't really pose practical barriers for AI achieving high levels of intelligence or solving complex real-world problems. The previous limitations in AI that Penrose pointed to, like playing Go, were overcome by better algorithms and knowledge representation, not by injecting quantum consciousness. Uncomputability theorems limit abstract mathematical provability, not necessarily practical intelligence.
Right. Okay. We have covered a lot of ground, from ancient Greeks to quantum physics. Let's try to pull the threads together in this final section, section 7.
Definitely. And it's crucial, as we've seen, to keep distinguishing between different concepts. Intelligence, problem-solving ability, thinking, information processing, intentionality, meaning aboutness, and consciousness, subjective experience. They're all tangled together, but they're not identical.
So looking back at the tests and challenges, the Turing test.
The source sees it as potentially useful for evaluating thinking intelligence if it's rigorous. It tests functional equivalence. And Gödel's theorem isn't really a practical barrier for AI intelligence.
And the Chinese room.
Powerful thought experiment highlights the semantics problem, the need for grounding, maybe embodiment, perhaps for qualia too. But the source views it as flawed as a test designed to give a no answer based on intuition. It doesn't rule out that physical simulation with the right substrate could work.
Which connects to organizational invariance.
Yeah, the idea that function depends on the pattern of interactions. But the source adds a nuance. Maybe at the lowest physical level, true functional identity requires physical identity. Silicon just isn't carbon, so perfect functional replication might need identical physics.
Leaving us with that big question, if we build systems that approximate brain function incredibly well, are we just building smarter AI, or could we actually create an artificial mind?
And the source suggests the answer depends entirely on how you define mind and how much similarity to a human you require. Similarity clearly matters for things like empathy-shared brain structures like mirror neurons help us resonate. And we humans are very quick to project intentions onto things, even simple robots.
The source also really grounds cognitive philosophy in physics, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It stresses that physical systems are computational processes. Simulating neurons accurately seems possible with known physics. And it raises that thought experiment again. If you gradually replace brain parts with functionally identical artificial ones, would consciousness just vanish? Probably not, suggesting a gradual shift, not an all-or-nothing biological magic.
So mind isn't just information, and it isn't just the physical stuff either.
Nope. Neither alone is enough. It's about the interaction, the complex patterns, the emergent structures. Simple views of just substance don't help us model cognition. Mind emerges from the complexity.
And the final message seems to be about bridging philosophy and science.
Yes, a strong call to connect philosophy of mind with the hands-on work in neurobiology and AI. The source leaves us with some big questions still hanging. Has philosophy really solved these core mind questions? Why does some philosophy seem disconnected from experiments? What exactly are we still missing to build an artificial mind?
And it encourages us to engage directly. Listen to interviews with advanced AI like LAMDA. Are you, the listener, convinced? Do any of Turing's original criticisms still feel powerful today? And why do super smart computers make dumb mistakes? Why do we?
It's been a whirlwind tour, hasn't it? From those early attempts to grapple with mind and body through behaviorism's limitations, the rise of cognitivism and functionalism.
Yeah, then wrestling with the Turing test, Searle's deep challenge with the Chinese room, and Penrose's arguments about computation's limits.
And that core tension just keeps running through it all, doesn't it? Is mind pure computation independent of what it's running on? Or does it need biology, specific causal powers, maybe even new physics?
The source seems to bet on progress through empirical science, understanding brains better, building better AI, especially these neuromorphic systems that try to copy brain architecture. But that ultimate mystery remains, bridging the gap from physical stuff and processing to subjective experience.
And here's that final provocative thought from the source to leave you chewing on. The feeling I understand is a brain signal. Lack of the feeling I understand doesn't mean a lack of understanding.
Whoa. Okay. What does that imply about our own feeling of knowing things? And how does that compare to the kind of understanding we're seeing in the most advanced AI today?
Definitely something to mull over.